Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past. Today we are talking to Daniel Karenberg and Miriam Cunay about the history of the RIPE NCC. So grab a pile of cookies, settle in, and listen as we meld with the finest minds in networking.
Hey.
Back on the history of networking.
Yeah.
Looks like you're in the office today.
I am.
You are. And today we have with us two very special guests, Daniel Karenberg and Marianne. I don't know how to pronounce your last name, Marianne.
Huna.
Okay. See, there you go.
So it's German. We're both German, actually.
Oh, okay. This is like Tony P. You ask him how to pronounce his last name, he says P. Don't bother. So, yes. So today we're talking about the origins of RIPE NCC with two of the people who helped found it. So this is really cool. So Daniel, why don't you start off telling us a little bit about the background and the history of RIPE NCC?
Well, it actually all started in the mid 80s when sort of internet TCP/IP first made its way into Europe in a larger sense, in a way where different sites got connected. The technology was used before mainly locally. When the sites that were doing it locally interconnected, there was a need for coordination and a lot of need to actually talk to each other and see what worked and what didn't, you know, technical stories and stuff like that. And all that sort of happened, but it all happened informally. Not only because it was new, but also because it was mainly used in publicly funded research and development. The official public policy was to use some other stuff, which was called the ISO protocols. So we were all doing this kind of as an informal U-boat-like activity. And by the end of the 80s, 88, it became clear that this was the way to go, at least to most of the engineers. And we said, hey, we need a forum to actually talk to each other. So in 1989, some of us stuck out their heads and basically said, hey, we'll just call for a meeting. And then we had three meetings a year suddenly because we realized that people wanted to talk about their experiences and also make arrangements for interconnections and things like that. And there was actually space for three meetings a year of this thing called RIPE, which was basically the European IP Coordination Forum. And there was no organizational background to it quite by design because we didn't want to antagonize the official party line and our funding sources.
So back up one second. What does RIPE stand for? Because people
RIPE stands for Réseau IP Européen. It's a pun. At the time, it was very fashionable in academia and related fields in Europe to use sort of English acronyms with a French background. And there was at the same time Réseau Associé pour la Recherche Européenne, which was
rare,
exactly rare, which was the official coordination body for all the publicly funded research networks. Well, if we looked for a long time for a name for this, and actually it was a Texan named John Quarterman, who you might also interview maybe, who finally saw that a title on a slide that I made for some presentation in France, which was titled Réseau IP Européen, had this nice acronym. So it was a Texan who actually coined the phrase.
And this was an actual slide, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah, that was
an overhead projector.
Really, that was really sort of hardware acetate written with a pen.
Right.
Reused in many presentations, and one of them he turned my slides for me, and then he handed back the slide back to me with that one on top and said, here's your name, and I didn't see it. I mean, he really had to explain it to me.
Wow, that's really cool. So At the time, you said you were trying to keep from irritating or aggravating the powers that be. Why is that? I mean, what was?
Well, mainly because of that. That was the funding for most of the for all the national research networks. The funding came from the governments, and the government said, you know, "We want you to build a research network based on ISO standards." Yeah, and they were really caught between that requirement, political requirement, and the requirement from their users to deliver something that worked. And some of them looked at it. These are the government-funded research networks. Some of them were looking for being politically correct more, and some of the others were more pragmatic and said one thing and did the other. And there was a whole spectrum in between. And then there were things like EUNET, which I was part of, which was not publicly funded. We could do what we wanted, and we were just at that time converting our backbone network from UUCP to IP, just because the volume was so big, we could afford leased lines, and it made more sense to put IP on them than to use them with a so on forward protocol. So that was the background for RIPE, and that started, and then had three meetings a year for a decade or something like that, and then pretty quickly, in the fourth meeting or so, it became clear that there were some things that we were doing that needed professional support that couldn't be done with volunteers. And one of them was maintaining a database of the networks that were out there. So the famous or infamous RIPE database, which was maintained by volunteers. And it was clear that that needed a little bit more professional underpinning. At the same time, there were some people who weren't quite happy with the service we got from the Internic in terms of allocating addresses. And you know, putting the two together, there was also said, people said, if we have some paid professional help, they could also do that, because then these people would be in the same time zone, have better response times, and things like that.
Can I interrupt for a second, Daniel? Because I found this always a really fascinating story that there was RIPE was there first, like as a community, like a self-organized volunteer, small community of operators in Europe. And then they were looking for some professional help, as in somebody who organizes their meetings and runs the mailing lists and also keeps their database up to date. So basically like a secretariat for the RIPE community to run this. And then since that was already in place, you know, they thought, well, you know, might as well use the same secretariat to also hand out IP addresses a bit closer to us. So rather than having to go to the US to get IP addresses, you know, we could also use that professional or that small secretariat to do the IP address distribution amongst those networks. And I always thought it was interesting to note that it's not like an RAR just kind of didn't get created just out of thin air, but there was already a place and some coordination done before that. And so that was used as the same, you know, then kind of an additional service was added to that secretariat, if you will.
Yeah. But it's all, you know, the thing, my experience with these describing history is that very often in those stories, it's all sequential. First this, then that, then that, then that. But it's not really like that. It all happens in parallel. So you can tell the story like I did and Miriam just did. Is we had the secretariat, and it also then later got this regional number registry function. But it all went sort of interleaved because at the same time in the U.S. the FNC, the Federal Networking Council, which actually was looking for divesting some of this work out to other countries because there was a funding problem. Yeah. So and we were all talking to each other. So it's much more organic and interleaved than purely sequential steps. Yeah. So we had this idea to have a secretariat. At the same time, the FNC and basically said, well, why don't you do this yourselves? And it all sort of came together in the end.
Yeah, I always thought it was fascinating. We had a letter actually on the wall with the first IP address allocations that we got from the Internet, from Kim Hubbard at the time, who you might also still track down if you want to. And then we got the first like block of addresses basically sent over by mail on a letter, and then obviously still registered also with IANA. But yeah.
So what was the block? Do you remember? What was the block?
Was it 193?
You can look at RFC 1918.
Yeah.
The top half of that we later donated as RFC 1918 address space. So
192.
So it was 192.168.
Yeah. Something yeah. like that. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. And
there
was the address?
There were a couple of Bs. We can find out. I have it archived.
And was the address on the outside an IP address? No.
they sent us a letter. They sent us a letter in the post.
In an envelope with a physical address on it. Yes, in Amsterdam.
And of course, they didn't put airmail on it. So it took like 2 weeks or so to get to us. And of course, we knew what there was a parallel email as well. But they felt like this was historic enough to, actually, Kim Abbott felt it was historic enough to actually write a letter on paper.
Yeah, yeah. And this was also, Daniel, if I'm not mistaken, this was the first RAR and the first block that was basically allocated to the outside of the US.
Sorry for interrupting. Oh, definitely. That's one thing I'm pretty proud of. We were the first RAR. It took, I think, another 3 years or so to set up Aaron.
No, APNIC came first.
Yeah. Then.
Then Aaron. Yeah. I know what you mean. Yes.
APNIC, yeah. First came APNIC, then Aaron.
Then the other two.
But everybody sort of assumes that Aaron was the first, but because everything comes from the US, right?
Well, it was the Internic first, which wasn't actually called the Regional Internet Registry. It was kind of the Internic. And then WebNCC started, and then from there, APNIC, and after that, Aaron, yeah.
So how did it come about that you donated the top half of the 192.168 space to 1918?
Because there was a perception that we wanted more easily recognizable addresses. We're just looking at them to see whether they're European. So we got 193/8 next. And then rather than giving people the rest of the 192 block in the RFC was written at the same time. It was actually the predecessor of 1918. And I basically said, what do I do with this block? And John was saying, which ones do we use for the Cs? Because this was still classful. So RFC 1918 has these three classes in there.
John
Postel was a little bit like, which class Cs do we use? And I was a co-author, and I said, hey, use those. We'll use 193/8 for the next allocations. That's how that happened.
That's really interesting.
I believe that some of the Bs were a similar block that nobody wanted.
Yeah.
And of course, then we used 10/8 for the, since the ARPANET had just been switched off officially like a couple of months beforehand, we used 10/8 because we thought that's a good retirement for the ARPANET addresses.
That's actually interesting too, because almost everybody uses 10/8, you know, now. And what kind of annoys me about it is they use these for documentation, even though that's not really what they're for.
No, there are documentation prefixes on top of that, exactly.
Yeah. So it's kind of every time I read documentation, I'm like, stop using the 10/8. Just cut it out.
what I get sort of two or three emails a month as an author of 1918, sort of, why and how and what's the history of this. None of those students that sent me those emails because of their assignments knows that 10/8 used to be the ARPANET.
No.
that's a really interesting piece of history. So what about the other ones? There's a third one, right?
Yeah, there's another couple of Bs. I remembered at some point where they came from. It's in a standard email I sent to those students, so I can look it up. But they were similarly sort of abandoned addresses.
So why was 193 considered more European?
Because it was recognizable. If the first 8 bits were 193, it was then WebNCC address space. You could see that.
Okay.
And people preferred that over being somewhere in 192. Yeah.
And it was also at the time where you still had to do a lot of aggregation in order to reduce the prefixes in BGP. So people kind of knew that 193, was mostly used in Europe, and then you could see those aggregated prefixes, and we would can compare to other slash aids from other regions. And
Not really a technical reason, more like a vanity.
Administrative. Or,
Right. So the original geolocation routing.
something like that.
It's interesting that it started out as kind of a more of a social conversation, like a technical social conversation. It ended evolving into RIPE NCC as it exists today. Is there any more history there that's really interesting?
Oh, there's lots of history. I mean, first of all, of course, after we had this idea about having a secretariat, we wrote it up, as RIPE does, in a RIPE document. And then it took more than a year, actually, to get the funding sorted. It was a little bit difficult for the research networks, the national ones that were funded by the governments, which were the main users, because ISPs were just emerging, to actually fund and officially sort of fund an activity that was there to coordinate IP, right? It was kind of dialectic. So we needed to have the funding, and we also needed to have an organizational home, because we didn't want to set up a different company or something for that. And in the end, sort of after a little bit more than a year, we actually got this RARE Club, which was the National Research Networks, to be the organizational home and also do the process of bidding for host organizations, so where the office would be, and also to hire the first director. That took a lot of political machinations, you know, for them to do the dialectics and basically decide that they wanted to take this on. And the first business plan, if you wish, was for three people growing to five in 3 or 4 years' time. RARE graciously said, we'll do that. We went around with a hat beforehand, getting commitments from different networking organizations to chip in for the cost. So that was also fine. In the end, I think there were, I don't know officially, of course, because I was one of the candidates, but there was only two serious candidates for being the director. And my arm had to be twisted fairly heavily, because I was planning to get a PhD and all that stuff, and I had a plan, sort of. And I was working for a Dutch government research institution. In the end, my arm was twisted, and I said, okay, I'll do this for a year to set this up. And then give it to someone else, because my perception of it at the time was it was interesting enough to set up, but carrying on it would be a boring sort of administrative thing.
And not foreseeing the whole .com bubble raising and bursting, and it wasn't quite as boring as Daniel had foreseen it to be.
Yeah. Well, you're stealing all the next things. So the idea was, you know, what is it? I mean, maintain a database, organize a couple of meetings, distribute some address space. So in the end, I said, okay, I take a leave of absence for a year from my day job and do this. But I was also just starting a family. So I didn't want to move location. So I wrote in my application, like, I'm only take this job if it's in Amsterdam, because that's where I was. And that sort of preempted the whole process of finding a location, because there was only one place in Amsterdam that applied, and that was NIKEF, the Dutch High Energy Physics Institute, where Rob Loxal was located, who also happened to be the spokesman of RIPE at the time. It later became the chair of RIPE. On the 2nd of April in 1992, we started. But since there was a large overlap between the volunteers who were doing the work and the people who, in the end, started working at the RIPE NCC, we had a flying start. So we had everything up and set up on day one. And when the other staff actually started on the 1st of May, we were already up and running. We had an office, and we had computer infrastructure, which consisted of very cheap Sun ELC workstations, which we abused as servers.
I started a little later, as the 5th, I think. And then all the naming conventions, I remember all the naming conventions for all the servers and desktops were kind of translations of RIPE. So at some point, we kind of ran out of that. So everybody brought their own language, you know, so Daniel had something in Rife, like German for Rife. And then, but then somehow we kind of, we ran out of, like, there was one that's called Mature and so things like that. But then when we grew bigger, that didn't really scale anymore. So we had to come up with a more boring naming convention after that.
Yeah.
It's interesting because in this building of Rife, there was the original, you said something about ISO or OSI model stuff and OSI. And IP. How did you get funding to support something that was IP based? Because that must have been much more of a struggle than you're making it sound.
No. Okay. Well, the thing was, as I said before, the people who were under the official policies were getting public money, basically, were caught between being politically correct and doing something for their users that their users wanted. As time went on, in 1990-1991, they were more and more seeing that this IP thing would take off. And so there was more and more a basis for also doing that. So it went from, we'll only do ISO to we're going to do also IP, at least for some time. It's all dialectics. So and we worked quite hard to actually make that acceptable to the people who actually in the end had to make the decision. So we gave them a lot of help saying, hey, this is just for a transition phase, but we really need this. And don't your users need that too? So we went also to some of their users to clamor for it. And we also, what also helped is that places like EUNET were sort of precursor ISPs also committed to chip in money. And substantial money. So they could say, hey, this is a cooperation with industry. I mean, this was before all this liberalization stuff and cooperation with industry was de rigueur, but it still helped. Yeah. So there was a lot of, I wouldn't say scheming, but a lot of organizing the support for this. It was certainly not a foregone conclusion that RARE would do this. But we preferred them to do this over an external sort of organization, because that would have caused antagonism, right? It was much nicer to have the ISO camp organize this rather than organize it somewhere else where there could be, you know, friction and antagonism later. I have to say the credit for this really goes to Rob Bloxall, because I was a little bit more impatient, and there was a larger faction that was impatient and said, hey, let's just, you know, set up an association and do this. You know, we have the money. And Rob sort of was saying, but that in the long run, maybe not so stable. Let's do the thing that we eventually did. It's got the ISO OSI camp to actually be the home for this IP activity, which was,
and also
in retrospect, was a really smart move.
Yeah, especially also because most of the members, most of the participants of RIPE, and then later the contributors and members of the RIPE NCC were these academic networks, and they already were organized as part of that RARE association for academics. So it kind of made sense to put it under, or to at least collaborate with that other club. Whereas later on, obviously, the RIPE NCC and the membership grew much more into the ISP and the more commercial world, and then the RARE kind of felt maybe it was time to move out. Both parties actually felt it was time to become independent. But at the beginning, I think it was a really smart move to do it that way. Yeah.
And it was quite clear already, sort of when we started, that ratio between publicly funded users and members, when we didn't have quite have members, contributors, we called them. And the commercial contributors would certainly change over time. So, but at first it was really sort of going along with the head, and we had contributors meetings where we had at the first, actually the whole charging scheme was based on self-assigned sizes. So we basically told everyone, you could either be small, medium, or large. You declare, but we'll of course publish what you said. And that worked well for like 5-6 years. We had always had enough money. That wasn't the problem. There were even a lot of really small players who insisted on paying the large contribution, part of marketing. So that was quite nice.
Yeah, we're a large organization with a ripe NCC.
Exactly.
Don't laugh. I found that in sales brochures.
We even had to add extra large later on, I think.
Yeah.
We had more, an extra small too, to be fair. But
if I remember correctly, it was this thing where we had like Deutsche Telekom and the likes of them, who insisted that they were extra large. So we had to
create a new category for the really large people.
Really expensive category.
I'm actually surprised, you know, they didn't want to be in the extra small category to pay less.
Amazing. Yeah. Peer pressure still worked at the time.
That only came later. This was in the time, but actually now coming back to sort of my expectation of this being boring and going back to my PhD. So when the time came, the first internet bubble started, we had a huge backlog in the registry function in distributing the address space, and we were really really pressed to hire people and to ramp this up, to ramp up the database, to fulfill all the requests for information on how do we do this internet stuff and so on. So we went and ended up hiring. I mean, like crazy, you know. Miriam is one of the victims of that.
I out of a sudden became a manager of a large team, which really wasn't the idea when I started, you know, because I started quite early on, but then we had to add more people and hire more. And so we developed all these departments, you know, set up registration.
Yeah, that was the second internet bubble.
Okay. Yeah, no, the first time around, I remember we had a really large wait queue. And I remember this one anecdote where the other three people went to the IETF, and I stayed back at the NCC doing the day-to-day business. And then the owner and boss of Demon at the time, I can't remember his name, Daniel, he had this pink Cadillac, and he was driving around Amsterdam. And they had an office in Amsterdam. Anyway, he came storming into our office demanding the addresses that he had requested some time ago, and he hadn't received an answer yet. And he was really surprised that there was one person in the office, and he's like, "You're doing all this work?" He all of a sudden became very humble and very friendly, and kind of understood, you know, why it took a little longer than he had expected. That was nice.
My story was that actually some of us at the IETF worked when Miriam slept.
We worked in shifts. Yeah.
And worked on the requests too.
That's true.
Yeah. So I felt at the come 1993 when I was scheduled to start my PhD work, I couldn't quite leave because it would have been irresponsible to leave during a time when everybody was stressed. So, and here I am still employed at the same place. Of course, the place then changed because of all these increases in staff and more work. I think 4 years into it, maybe even 3 years into it, we were like more than twice as many employees doing this ripe NCC thing than Rare had. As this was going on, the tail was really wagging the dog at some point. Rare realized that as well. And we worked with them actually to divest ourselves into an association. So we founded an association. Everybody who was a contributor became a member, and more people became members. We used that form because in Europe, that's the most democratic way of an organization. It's basically the membership elects a board, and the board hires people, and all the sort of the policy comes from the membership. And the other really good attribute of an association is that you can't sell it. So at the time, of course, all this stock options in startups and selling things left and right and mergers and things like that was in everybody's mouth. So we wanted something that couldn't be sold. And so we chose for the association.
It's maybe also interesting to point out, and people often don't understand the difference between RIPE and the RIPE NCC. And there's, of course, a big overlap between the participants of the RIPE community, this volunteer club, and the RIPE NCC members. But What's important is that the RIPE community, it's still functioning. It's still a volunteer group. It's not a legal entity. It still meets in this now 2 times a year. And they're the ones who are making most of the decisions also on how IP addresses or how the RIPE NCC basically functions and what the policies are, how these IP addresses are distributed, what's registered in the database. So the members make decisions about the budget and the actual activities, but the RIPE community, all these volunteers, they actually really have a lot of influence in steering what the RIPE NCC does and how these addresses and IS numbers and other resources are handed out. Yeah. And that's different, I think, than in other regions. So that's really important. And that's why I think it's also interesting to stress that RIPE was there first and then the RIPE NCC started. And it still kind of works that way.
Yeah. It's also from the history. When RIPE started as a U-boat kind of informal thing, we carried it through because it has the real nice property that it has a very low threshold. It's just the same threshold as the IETF, basically. You turn up. And so all the sort of technical decisions, the decisions about address policy and so on, are made in this low threshold community. And the association really runs the secretariat. And their purview is what should be the membership fee, hire the management and fire them, basically.
I assume like legal things, like enforcing that nobody uses.
All the contracts are held by this thing. Whereas explicitly the association acknowledges the authority of RIPE over the policy bit. And that makes for us makes sense. It makes other things very difficult. For instance, we were very lucky for more than 25 years, more than a quarter century, to have Rob Bloxall as our chairman, because he had the authority and the gravitas and the support of everybody. And so we just sidestepped the whole issue of how do we elect our leadership when he decided he didn't want to do it anymore, and he subsequently passed away. He basically appointed his successor, but we still had this problem, and it took us more than
5 years. Five years.
More than 2 years, anyway.
to come up with the process, which in the end we stole from the IETF, which is of course way over. What's the word? Like too heavy for the RIPE community, because we only need one position to fill, basically. But still, you know, we took a lot from the IETF process because it's proven, you know, to work and
it's something people could agree on.
Exactly.
So I guess that's a big part of it, is in this type of community situation, you spend a lot of time building consensus like you do in the IETF rather than top down, which my impression of the OSI or the ISO is that the ITU is that it's much more top-down, driven by the bigger vendors type of thing.
Well, one of the things I would also like to say is the way of looking at distribution of resources, and specifically IP addresses, you can put models on how this works that are either top-down or bottom-up. Both explanations work. What's usually in the nature of society and people is that you use the top-down model. You basically say, hey, yeah, it's all done under the authority of the US government, and now I can because they divested it. And there's the IANA, and then the IANA allocates addresses to regional registries, and the regional registries allocate it to the end users or to ISPs, and they then to end users. And then the IETF is coming from the side and says, hey, that's our address space, so it's also under our authority, and la 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 la. That's the top-down way of looking at it. There's also the bottom-up way of looking at it that's much less publicized. But my bottom-up model is the following. Who defines whether an integer is an IP address? Well, it's the network operators, the ISPs. Because if they agree that this number is here, then they agree on it somehow. We, as the RIPE NCC, could jump through all sorts of hoops and say, hey, it's in our database. If it's not in the routing table, that doesn't matter, nothing. So so you could say that if the top-down model did anything that really contravened the interests of the ISPs, they could make a little revolution and basically say, oh, no, this stuff we don't recognize, right? So both models fit reality to a certain extent. And the bottom-up one is usually disregarded because people have a preference for somehow for thinking top-down.
Oh, there's a sense that there's more security in the top-down model, for one thing. I don't know that I agree with that. I'm just saying that, you know, there are perceptions out there of it's more secure, it's single source of truth, that type of thing. But yeah, I mean, in the long run, it's the providers and the providers' customers, the people who pay the providers to do what they do that make the difference in making this whole thing work. So really, the power should kind of follow the money in some sense.
Yeah, not only the money maybe, but it's amazing sometimes how these policies are, I mean, same like in the IETF, and how consensus is built and how these operators made policies that aren't necessarily in the interests of, you know, of one of them or of, you know, themselves. Like, for instance, how the last /8 of IPv4 addresses was distributed was in small chunks. Now, they could have just decided, oh, let's just distribute it among ourselves and not, you know, forget about future market engines, but they didn't. And of course, it's also in the interest of them to maybe allow new customers onto the market and so forth. But there are some other examples how they really, as a group, kind of try to make the most reasonable decision for everybody instead of just for who has the biggest mouth or the biggest money, you know, pockets.
Yeah. So the .com bubble, it burst, and then what was the impact on Ripe NCC and Ripe?
Well, the impact was that we had to run less hard.
And we were all very happy as staff. We were really happy to be in the, like, for instance, a lot of my friends went into, like, you know, startups and commercial, and they were like laughing at me that I'm sitting at this not-for-profit organization with like a monthly salary. But I was really happy in the end that I got a salary and I didn't get bankrupt, you know, with one of those small companies. So
yeah, no, but we were happy because it allowed us to catch up.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it wasn't going into decline, it was just the growth just went less steeply.
Yeah.
So it allowed us some way to catch up, and then when the next bubbles or next accelerations hit, we were sort of ready for them.
Yeah, we were prepared. Yeah.
We were prepared. We had never, the one thing is, we never ever had a money problem. Yeah. There's always critical mass of contributors to fit the bill.
Yeah, and to the contrary, we always underestimated the growth year after year after year.
Yeah.
And then not, I mean, until today, but now it's going down a little bit. Well, it's still growing, but it's not growing as fast, obviously, because we ran out of IPv4. And so we'll have to see what's going to happen in the future.
So V6 is making a difference here as well, right? How is the V6? I mean, when did V6 first hit Ripe NCC and Ripe? Was that resisted at first, or was that something that people just glommed onto and said, yes, let's go do this?
Well, there's a whole another anecdote we could talk about how we developed the first IPv6 allocation policies, because, you know, the IETF obviously developed IPv6, and when the RFCs came out, they also felt like, you know, they want to decide how the addresses get distributed. And we're like, wait a minute, there's another club here, they're all the operators who are actually have a good track record in deciding how to distribute the IPv4 addresses, so why don't we let them also do this for IPv6? So we all got together at the time. We were three RARs at the time, but we also got Steve Deering with us, who was one of the authors of the RFC at the time, and just so that we understand all the technical backgrounds. And so we all kind of locked ourselves in into an apartment and tried to come up with the first IPv6 allocation policies. I don't know when that was. It must have been in 90... in 90s, right? When did the RFC come out? I can't remember. But yeah, so we expected it to take off quite steeply, but then, as we all know, it didn't. And so CIDR came along at roughly the same time, and then NAT, and so the whole...
CIDR was a long time before that.
It was before, but I mean, but the point is that people came up with more and more tricks and hoops, you know, to try to extend the lifetime of IPv4 rather than moving on to IPv6. So we also tried a few tricks, you know, like, for instance, until recently, with every IPv4 allocation, you also got an IPv6 allocation, or the other way around, you have to have an IPv6 allocation first before you got more IPv4, you know, all these kind of tricks to make it more popular.
But to answer, the other answer to the question is that it really depends there were all sorts of types of address space users. There were the ones, the enthusiasts that basically said, hey, let's go to IPv6. And at first there were, of course, the smaller, more technologically oriented places. And then you have this whole sort of deployment and development thing where more and more of the larger operators realize that their growth could be impacted by not doing this. And so more and more do it first internally only and tunnel IPv3, 4 through it. And there's lots of deployment scenarios. I think we have the whole spectrum from really IPv6 only places, very few of them, through sort of the middle ground of various shades and so on, to places that basically say we don't care, we just, you know, we have enough or we buy IPv4. And it all depends on their situation, but certainly if you want to grow in terms of endpoints, in terms of hosts, if you wish, then there's no way to sustain it with IPv4 only.
So what's the future for RIPE and RIPE NCC? Now that we've kind of like talked a little bit about the history and how it came about, is it more of the same? Do you have big plans going into the future? Are you?
I think one of the things I've always stressed is that we're not just this registry. People try to reduce us to this address space distribution function, but we're really an association of ISPs where they do stuff that is best done in a central place that answers to the ISPs. What I would like to see is that we continue the activities that we have in terms of measuring the internet in various dimensions and making that data available in a neutral place and things like that. So my personal plans are to extend the activities and look for activities that the ISPs have to organize as a group in a neutral place. So to develop this neutral place, that's my vision.
Yeah, and since the RIPE NCC, and when you say ISPs, I guess it's a lot more these days than ISPs. We have a lot of enterprises also, but basically network operators in whatever form they
network
come.
Network operators is probably the better choice of words here.
But since we have this track record also for such a long time and as a neutral place and neutral organization, we've always done a lot more than just handing out IP addresses, as Daniel said. So we have a lot of other services and products and tools and data and statistics that people really make a lot of use of. Like a lot of researchers also use it, and network operators. And so I think also that I agree with Daniel. That's the past and also the future, and also together with these IP addresses and the database that we have, we collected a lot of data, also routing information, service, BGP information, like the measurements, and that's I think going to continue as well. Yeah. Plus, of course, we're going to still be the registry, so run the database in a reliable and accurate way, and because that needs to be a central function. But in addition to that, I also like to see us to do a lot more for the community. And
I know that RIPE does a lot of training, a lot of best common practice type documents, and RIPE Atlas, right?
Yes.
Atlas is a huge one.
That's what the measurements, that's what Daniel meant with the measurements. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know about Atlas. I talk about it when I do a couple of classes that I do, and people are really amazed that Atlas is out there and how open it is and how much you can use it for a lot of different things. So
that's good to hear.
Yeah,
but it's not only Atlas as well. You know, we also do routing. We collect BGP routes and do also the other things, but I'm pretty proud of Atlas actually.
Yeah, that was one of Daniel's brainchilds.
there's of course a lot of mothers.
Another thing is, I know that a lot of the transits are struggling right now to find their purpose in life. Do you think RIPE plays a big part in doing that, or is RIPE going to focus as much on content providers and stuff like that? as other things?
I think one of the things that's part of the success of RIPE and the RIPE NCC is that we focused on the network operators. We never went into the domain name space quite consciously, and we never went into other sort of lobbying kind of things. Well, the temptation was there, and suggestions were there. So I think we'll keep focused on being the neutral place for network operators, you know, ISPs and other sort of large network operators. I don't think we need to look for more reasons for being. I think there's enough to do there, and we have a lot of trust in that developed in that community, and we will work to keep that trust and build on it. So that's the thing I tried to say earlier when I had the blank. The important thing is that we both RIPE and the RIPE NCC stay relevant in being the forum and the associated services and secretariat for this network operator community, and do everything that they would need to do in a neutral place in our service region, in this region of 100 countries, and not to supplant regional kind of efforts, help them, and not to do sort of local things, not to do operations, but everything else that needs a sort of a neutral place, we should make ourselves available. Yeah. And then maybe divest it. Yeah, later on, which we did. We actually, there was the top level domain administrators of our service region couldn't quite get together
for the country code top level domains.
The country code top level domain, the CCTLDs, wanted to organize a similar sort of club, and they couldn't do it. So we basically said, okay, we'll help you for a little while, but we don't want you under our umbrella. We'll help you as the RIPE NCC to set it up, and we helped them like a year or two to run meetings and stuff like that with our expertise there. And then we said, thank you, please go and organize it yourself, so we could also be an incubator in that sense.
But to come back to your question quickly, Russ, I think also within the RIPE community, I mean, technology has changed over time, challenges have changed, you know, the transit providers and the content and more regulation or not, you know, but I think the RIPE community is also like flexible enough to address that, to embrace that, you know, like, I don't know, as a small example, we now have a working group about IoT and what the security risks are. And so maybe there's something else, maybe we're going to have a quantum internet working group soon and see how that could benefit from talking to the kind of traditional network operators, you know, so things will evolve. And so if the transits come, for instance, and say, hey, we want to have a small working group to talk to each other within that RIPE community, I'm sure there will be space for that as well. So that doesn't necessarily mean the RIPE NCC activities will change, but the topics around us, I think we can facilitate that.
Yeah, cool. Actually, this quantum thing is a very good example of what happens here. There's researchers doing sort of basic research in quantum networks, and they see that in order to control their networks, they also need internet protocols. So what they do, they're really clever, they go to the IETF to actually get those protocols going, but they're even cleverer because they saw, well, we also need to engage with the operators of the current networks.
Yeah.
And so we, as in RIPE, and the RIPE NCC as a secretariat, we work with them to organize hackathons, present, organize working groups, like Miriam says, getting the developers of something new in contact with the operators and getting expose the operators to what's happening. And that's where I see a core function of RIPE, and of course the RIPE NCC helping with that.
Miriam, any place anybody can follow what you're working on other than just the RIPE website? Like, are you on LinkedIn or Twitter or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm so we have the RIPE Labs a platform, like that's more the like a community blog, and there is a RIPE Labs Twitter handle also, which is kind of the community everything we do as a community service, and opposed to the Ripe NCC Twitter handle, which we also have. And okay. I'm also personally on LinkedIn, like under okay. my own name. Yeah.
Okay. And Daniel, any place anybody can follow what you're working on?
Did you
ever finish your PhD, by the way?
No, I never started it. That was the point. I was poised to start it. I had actually already found promoters. But luckily they had full understanding.
I'm told you're never too old to begin. I'm actually in my dissertation yeah. phase on my PhD. So
wow.
You know, I'm told you're never too old to begin. So,
interesting. See, I might have to go back to that too, because I remember when I finished my computer science degree, I felt like now for a change, I want to do something real, and that I left academics and went into this internet thing. But yeah, maybe it's not too late to go back and start.
Yes.
But coming back to where you can follow me, I'm sort of getting really out of the operational business. And my personal plan is also to get out of sort of being on the front line for Ripe. But Ripe Labs is a good place to find stuff that I do. And usually what I do sort of technically is can be found there.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you both for coming on History of Networking. And I'll let you know when this publishes.
Okay. Good luck with editing. Editing our chaos.
Yes, our chaos, yes.